You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Modica.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora.
Well, we're up to stage five, almost a quarter of the way through our Giro d'Italia. Where are we, Lionel?
We're still in Sicily, the second of 3 days on the island. The Giro visited Sicily in 2017 for a couple of days. We'll talk a lot more about Mount Etna tomorrow, but when the Giro was in Sicily in 2017, there was a stage finish in Vincenzo Nibali's hometown, Messina, which was won by Fernando Gaviria. And the following year, 2018, there were a couple of stage wins for Tim Wellens and Enrico Batallin before they went to Etna. As I say, we'll talk about Etna tomorrow. It's looming. Hopefully it won't erupt all over us, virtually or otherwise. So we're enjoying a jaunt across the island.
This was peak nervous napalm a few years ago when we were on Etna, wasn't it? This was came after several days when everything had conspired against you, napalm, and I think we could hear a rumbling, we could feel a rumbling as we were on our way up the mountain. You thought that was it for us, didn't you?
I thought my computer had broken. It was refusing to turn on. Not ideal at the start of a grand tour, that, to go around without a computer.
And Messina, there was an embarrassing moment, wasn't there, for one of Nibali's young teammates who thought he'd won the stage and stuck his hands up in there a lap early.
Yes. Who was it? It was a Slovenian. Not Polanc, the other fella, Bahrain. Similar name to Polanc.
That's right, Daniel. It was Luca Pibernik, who is still at Bahrain McLaren. He did a Chris Boardman, as British cycling fans will, if you're watching the Tour de France in 1994. Chris Boardman did that, didn't he? Down in Brighton, I think.
Don't remember that, did he? I remember he attacked. He attacked Bahrain, he was off the front, but I don't remember him thinking he'd won. Filippo Pozzato did that famously, didn't he? Well remembered, the line. I forgot you were our Slovenian correspondent, of course, so those names are all on the tip of your tongue.
That was one of those incidents where we found it, everyone in the press, everyone watching it found it funny. And then when you went to, well, I went to the Bahrain Merida bus that evening and tried to speak to Pibernik, and he was absolutely mortified. And he'd also got the hairdryer treatment from one of his director sportifs, who were not very amused by what he'd done.
I mean, it'd be like your trousers falling down, wouldn't it, on public transport or something, or somewhere in public. Hugely embarrassing.
Well, almost as embarrassing as saying Chris Boardman had done the same thing, but I'm sure he did. My memory might be playing tricks on me.
I don't think he did. And if you're listening, Chris, I apologise on behalf of Lionel. Lionel, can we have the tale of the Tapa, please?
We can. This is a stage from Agrigento to Modica. It's exactly the same stage as the Grande Partenza in 1999, when a relatively unknown sprinter riding for the Mobil Veta team, Ivan Quaranta, pulled the Lion King's tail, so to speak. Mario Cipollini was the hot favourite to win that stage, but could only finish third. And Quaranta, who's going to feature heavily in the first third of today's episode, didn't he also have a feline nickname, Daniel?
He did, the leopard. I asked him about this, but he told me that the gentleman who came up with that nickname was a family friend. He dubbed him the leopard, the leopard being the fastest animal or the fastest cat in the jungle. And this was a sort of deliberate dig at Mario Cipollini. Cipollini, of course, was the Lion King. But the gentleman, the friend who did come up with that nickname, apparently he died about a week ago from coronavirus.
Point of order, isn't the cheetah the fastest animal in the...
I don't know. I had one yesterday and I could see it coming as well, about Hungarian not being related to any other European languages. Very, very distantly related to Finnish. But I'm not even going to get into this.
I mean, cheetah would be a problematic nickname for a cyclist or any athlete, really, wouldn't it? Anyway, sorry, carry on, Lionel.
Well, I'm just looking this up about Quaranta. Il Gepardo.
Gepardo, yeah.
Gepardo, and that's a, that's a cheetah.
Did I say the leopard?
Yeah, you did.
You said leopard.
The leopard, yeah, it's anyway. It's the leopard.
Anyway, big cats are going to be a theme of a couple of stages coming up towards the end of the week as well. Anyway, today's stage is largely flat in Giro terms. We're going along the coast, rising slightly at the end, of course. Well, this Giro includes a lot of climbing, so let's hear from the course.
so much for a meander along the coast. A lot of riders very unhappy with race director Daniele Fribarincini, especially a day like this coming just before Etna tomorrow. I've heard rumours of a protest. Tomorrow's stage might just stop at the foot of Etna en masse, led by the Lion of the Chilterns, or alternatively the Elephant of Watford. The name seems to be going by now. He is our latter-day Fabian Cancellara, and I think we're all looking to him to register some kind of protest at the severity of the route so far. Anyway, onward.
I hope nobody's scrutinising my results too closely, but I am riding every day. That's my commitment. Well, I just wanted to confirm that, I hadn't defamed Chris Boardman. He did, in fact, attack out of the bunch when the tour visited Britain in 1994. The stage finish was in Brighton. He thought he was away on his own, but in fact, there were three riders up the road. And there's a picture in a book, which was done by Phil O'Connor and Graham Watson, called Boardman. And he's giving it full beans as he crosses the line, a full victory celebration.
Talk about taking us down a cul-de-sac here, though. What is coming up in today's episode?
Well, we're going to be talking, Rich, about what we're calling supernovas. And I'm not an expert on big cats. I'm not necessarily even an expert on, the relationship of Finnish and Hungarian. And I don't even know whether it's astrology, isn't it? Not astronomy. I'm definitely not an astrologist. I'm not the man to really give the perfect definition of a supernova. But we think it's something, a star that burns pretty brightly and then fades. In relation to the Giro, there have been lots of these in Giro history, riders who have done their best work in the Giro and never really, they've either imploded, faded, waned, or they've not gone on to reproduce the same sort of results in other races, notably Tour de France.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWOCAP. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsors, iWOCA, an award-winning finance company that specialises in lending to small businesses. The company has issued more than £1 billion to companies ranging from startups to established businesses. They can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, and by making it quick and easy to apply for a loan and get a quick decision, it can be a more flexible option than approaching the big banks. iWOCA also supports cycling, sponsoring the Kendal Cycle Club, as well as the Cycling Podcast, of course. For more information, go to iwoca.co.uk.
Giro Dream Team with Ciro Scognamiglio.
Second rider is Elia Viviani. Dear listeners, with no other single rider, it's so easy to work. Why? Well, Elia is so brilliant in his answers, but he is also capable to do questions. When he starts to speak, it's almost impossible to stop him. Also for this reason, we friendly call him Radio Viviani. As Freddie Mercury teach us, remember the fabulous 80s. All we hear is Radio Gaga. In this case, it's all we hear is Radio Viviani. Go, Elia!
Well, that was Ciro Scognamiglio, our friend in Italy, with the latest member of his dream team.
Radio Viviani.
Yeah, as he explained in his first selection, he's not picking any climbers at all. So I think we can see a theme beginning to emerge and develop. But he and Viviani get on very well, don't they?
Yeah, they've had their ups and downs, though, haven't they? Remember there was a couple of years ago where they had a bit of a spat?
It seems unlikely because Viviani's quite an unusual sprinter in that he's a pretty calm, measured guy, isn't he, most of the time. Controversially wore that Italian Champions jersey at the Giro last year that didn't bring him any luck at all. In today's episode, as you said, Daniel, we're looking at riders who've burned brightly but briefly at the Giro d'Italia over the years. We're going to pick out around about 10, maybe come up with a podium at the end of Champagne Supernovas.
Prosecco Supernovas.
Number one,
maybe.
Prosecco Supernovas. Our first pick, though, is somebody that you've swung to recently, and is a name that people will kind of vaguely remember, perhaps, without knowing an awful lot about him.
Yeah, what do you chaps remember about Ivan Quaranta?
I just remember the shock of that first win in 99. I mean, he was a relatively unknown rider. He might well have been better known in Italy, but he was riding for a second division team, wasn't he? Mobile Vetta.
Yeah, Mobile Vetta.
Cipollini ruled.
Well, they were kind of the crazy gang of Italian cycling. They had all sorts of very motley bunch of misfits, like Pascal Richard. I don't know how old he was in the 1999 Giro, but I think they burned the candle at both ends. We'll hear about that later anyway.
But Cipollini was the king of the jungle at the time, wasn't he? And it was a real upset.
Yeah, it was, chaps. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, he seemed to come from nowhere. He'd actually turned pro for Polti a couple of years earlier, and it'd gone pretty badly. It looked as though he wasn't going to really have what it took to be a top road pro or a top sprinter. He'd mainly ridden on the track as a youngster. And but his team did get a ride in 99 Giro. It was starting from Modica. Cipollini was the best sprinter in the world at the time, the king of the jungle, and everyone expected Cippo to don the first pink jersey. And probably, knowing him, it would have been the pink jersey, pink shorts, pink socks, pink everything. But that's not what happened.
La prima tappa c'era una salita, mi ricordo, a 30 dall'arrivo, 40 km dall'arrivo.
On that first stage, I remember there was a climb 30 or 40 kilometres from the finish, then we went down the other side, and then it was 15 or 20 kilometres on the flat to the line in Modica. I got dropped near the top of the climb and went over the summit 30 seconds or so down on the front group of about 60 guys. Mario Manzoni and Mirko Gualdi dropped back to help me. We went hell for leather down the descent, and we eventually got back on with about 15 kilometres to go. From there, I went into autopilot, maybe naive or just carefree, as you are at that age. When you've already had a good season, you know you're there to learn and you don't have much responsibility.
Controlled by the red squad of Mario Cipollini. Cipollini there, currently in second position, but he's going to get challenged by your own Blijlevens, who's in pretty good condition so far this season. But Blijlevens, for the moment, a little bit too far down there in 10th place.
Indeed he is, and the Seiko boys again seem to have control of this, but Cipollini now trying to take this one, but he's being rushed all of the way here, and this is Blijlevens and Quaranta who's challenging him. Well, that is amazing, because they've really forced their way through the pack here.
Now Cipollini
So I got back on, did what I could, basically without a train, without anything, and maybe a bit by fluke, I found myself on Cipollini's wheel. I was definitely handy on a bike when it came to knowing my way around a bunch, bike handling, touching the brakes a lot less than other people, because I'd always raced on the track in the youth categories. So that day, I'd found all the gaps and was on Mario's wheel as we came into the last bend. Round there, then it was 250 or 300 metres slightly uphill. I beat Mario to the draw, launched my sprint first, and I managed to beat him.
L'ho anticipato, sono riuscito a batterlo.
Gore team leading out for the line there now as the field strings out here in Modica. Now looking down, Cipollini on the far right, they cross the line. Well, that was Ivan Quaranta who took it for Mobile Vetta North Wave. Now watch this, because this is a little bit of a blow to Cipollini, because Quaranta, taking his sixth win of the season, is going to be delighted at having beaten Cipollini and Jerome Blijlevens.
Sicuramente, perché l'ho capita dall'interesse che c'era.
Oh, I definitely knew my life had changed straight away. I could tell from all the fuss and interest 1 minute after I'd won, from both fans and the media. Winning stages is one thing. You can win what you like. But if you wear the pink jersey, all eyes are on you, especially in a place like Sicily, which isn't a region of great cycling connoisseurs. A lot of fans there mainly just want to see the pink jersey. They might not even know his name, but the pink jersey is the pink jersey. On the night itself, we partied. I went to bed at midnight because, well, we hadn't gone there thinking about winning a stage. We were a really small team, the Bardiani of our day, and you go there and you win the very first stage against all the biggest teams and the biggest riders in the world. Well, you can imagine what the celebrations were like. The hotel was besieged by fans, because that's the other thing. The Sicilians are convivial by nature and they love a party. There were 300 fans outside the hotel. Then came the next day. You know, you're in a bubble when something like that happens, and you only really appreciate some things later when you step outside of that bubble. One of the things I remember is that the race started the next day, and every time we passed a house or a shop window, I was looking to see myself in the pink jersey in the reflection. It was funny. You know, usually you're not looking at the reflection of the peloton in a window trying to spot yourself. At the same time, as I was looking and seeing myself, I couldn't quite believe that that was me in the pink jersey. It was a beautiful feeling, a memory to last a lifetime. The other thing was that I got three times as much attention from women. They called me a donnaiolo later, a lady killer, but I don't think I was any worse than anyone else in that regard. I just did it in broad daylight.
I mean, I think we can all relate, Daniel, to checking ourselves out in the garage
windows. I knew you were going to say this.
Come on, you show me a cyclist who's not studied at least their position on the bike.
What about the bit about tripling female attention, you know?
Perhaps not so much as a result
of a famous victory. Did that happen to you, Rich, after your victory in the Tour of the Trossachs, Stage 2A, 1994?
I didn't really know. Not that I was aware of, anyway. Anyway, that was a bit of Ivan Quaranta.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a lovely image, lovely memory. He's a great character, Ivan Quaranta, and he was someone who sort of endeared himself to the Italian press and public, probably, as you know, for reasons you can understand listening to that clip. He was a larger than life character, and it was a real sort of shot across Cipollini's bows, that first stage win. And then Cipollini, well, Quaranta started, as you said there, he started the second stage in the pink jersey, and Cipollini got it back, so he won the second stage. But it was a real ding-dong between them for the rest of that Giro, in the sprints. And Quaranta, I mean, he was someone who completely the opposite of Cipollini as far as sprints were concerned. He didn't really need a train, didn't really like having a train. He sort of was a kind of counter-punching sprinter. And whenever he got the jump first on Cipollini, he tended to cause him problems. Well, there was another occasion where he got the better of him. Yeah, that became, well, not so much the stage itself, but what happened after that stage became the stuff of legend. And let's just hear from Ivan Quaranta about that now. So that story, well, first of all, bear in mind that cycling's changed. No one goes clubbing in the middle of a stage race anymore. Not even Sagan, who might seem like a bit of a nutter, or Boonen back in the day. They couldn't do what we did because everything's changed. They make a lot more sacrifices, are a lot more professional than we were. Anyway, I'd won the first stage of the Giro, got some other good results, seconds and thirds, and then I won in Cesenatico, Pantani's hometown. Try to imagine what the crowds were like there at the absolute peak of Marco's popularity after he'd won the Tour and the Giro the previous year.
Quella zona c'è anche fior di discoteche, no? Se vuoi, volendo.
Ecco, bravo. È lì dove volevo arrivare. Praticamente.
And yes, in that area, there are nightclubs like you wouldn't believe. Precisely. That's what I was getting to. After the stage that evening, we'd arranged to go out with Cipollini, because he'd also won two stages and we were both happy with our Giro. Plus, it was going to be impossible for us to make it to Milan that year. There were three or four huge mountain stages coming up in the last week. So that night, our team managers, mechanics, masseurs, and so on had all agreed that we would go to a nightclub and crack open a bottle of champagne or two. It's not like we were going to dance until 5 in the morning and get drunk. There ended up being about 10 of us in the club, me, three of my teammates, Mario and a few of his. And we'd been there for a while when suddenly these journalists and photographers turned up. They took a couple of photos, Mario made a quick getaway, and then we were left there, which is why in the next day's papers there were all these reports, Quaranta goes clubbing and so on, and the image stuck. After that, I was always the party boy in their eyes. You know how it works. I mean, I definitely could have won more in my career, but I also could have won less. Trust me, to win 39 races on the road in a career, you have to train and you have to live like a bit of an athlete. Although, yes, it's true, I could have won more. So nightclubbing in the middle of a Giro d'Italia, I'd heard that story at the time, and it was a tag that Quaranta carried with him for the rest of his career, that of a playboy sprinter. And it was true to a certain extent, but as he said there, it wasn't something that he was doing every night. And you know, the next couple of years, he did become quite a character and quite a major figure. As far as the Giro was concerned, there was no real suggestion of him, well, because he wasn't in a team that was ever going to ride in the Tour at that point, but there was never a suggestion of him going to the Tour de France. But in the next Giro, he won two stages, and in the one after that, he won two stages as well. So six in total. They're not really a flash in the pan, not really a one-hit wonder. But then it all ground abruptly to a halt. You know, there was a lot of criticism of him for being overweight, not being professional. Again, this idea that he was sort of out on the tiles every night. And he got his big move to Saeco, which is where Cipollini really had done his best work. Quaranta sort of came in as a replacement for Cipollini in 2003, and it was a bit of a disaster. And that was the beginning of the end for Quaranta, as he explained to me here.
Sì, loro speravano di trovare un corridore da classiche piuttosto che un sostituto di Cipollini, piuttosto che...
You know, they hoped that they'd found a classics rider or some kind of new Cipollini or even a new Nicola Minali. But I was a rider who went pretty well on a very specific type of course, and that was about it. I used to get dropped on every climb. As a junior and right up until my first year as an under 23, I only rode the Flying 200 on the track. So in the space of 4 years, I'd undergone a transformation that was almost too radical. I had 4 or 5 years when I was competitive and winning. I mean, I won nearly 40, not 3 races. Those years I did Paris Tour and I always got dropped. I did San Remo and always got dropped. See what I mean? And it wasn't because I wasn't training. That was just the rider I was. I could cling on to a gruppetto to finish races. But in really hard races, I was never up there and in contention. You know what it means to be a track sprinter. It means doing 10,000 kilometers a year, as opposed to 35,000 if you're a road pro. And it means spending a lot of time in the gym. A training session for me was 50 standing starts and 10 sprints behind a derny. That was it. Then showering home. But in Italy, there wasn't much future for a track rider. And since I went okay on the road, people encouraged me to give it a go. So from that to finishing the 2001 Giro in a few years was a massive achievement for me. That year, I also could have won the final sprint in Milan, except my derailleur had broken and I had to sprint in the 12 sprocket. So I only finished fifth, but we still partied that night. What else are you going to do? So that was Ivan on why it didn't work in the sort of tail end of his career. And then he did actually have quite a few problems when his career ended. I mean, by his own admission, he sort of got in with a bit of a bad crowd or a group of guys, a lot of them cyclists actually, who had retired and were a bit directionless in life. And one of them was a guy called Valentino Foyce, who'd ridden for Mappe. I think he'd ridden for Mercatone Uno. And he unfortunately developed a cocaine addiction. He was a good friend of Quaranta's, and he died in, I think, 2007 or 2008. And that was a big source of regret for Ivan for quite a number of years, that he hadn't been able to help his mates. But all much better now for Quaranta. His son, I think his son's called Samuele, is a very promising under 23 rider.
Our first champagne supernova, maybe emphasis on the champagne rather than the supernova. He wasn't really a flash in the pan, but I guess being in the shadow of Mario Cipollini can't have been that easy for an Italian sprinter. Who is our next champagne supernova contender,
Daniel? Well, I've
got
a cracker here, chaps. But before that, let's revisit the day, the stage, when this gentleman came very much to the fore.
I remember...
Lionel, this is extraordinary, even by Giro standards. This is a true casino, a true mess.
It is, really. I mean, we've been sent all across the Dolomites, down the farm tracks and country roads, and now we've got to take a cable car up to the finish. And there's no indication in the road book that this is what we had to do to get from the start to the finish. Had we known, it's highly likely we would have got moving a bit earlier, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and I think the all-course itinerary today, or our all course, so that's off course itinerary, has been inspired by a bowl of spaghetti, hasn't it?
It's been a shocker.
All the compliments for Mauro Vegni and the organisers of the Giro for yesterday's extraordinarily beautiful, fantastic Dolomite blockbuster have been forgotten. As I said earlier, Lionel, I know it's your last day and you appear to be dribbling over the line. The motivation, motivation is still good, but energy levels, concentration levels, certainly levels of planning seem to have dwindled alarmingly in the last few hours.
Yeah, I mean, I've done quite a lot of the driving this week, haven't I?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And I think my mental finish line was the long drive after the stage last night. And looking at the road book yesterday, today looked like it was going to be a picnic. We were 3 kilometres away from the start. We managed to make a mess of that. Had to do a 30k diversion up the auto route, autostrada, sorry, and back. Then we got kind of locked in at the start, and now we're still
floundering. We're floundering around, hapless, floundering.
Yeah, but this is all part of it, isn't it? I mean, you know, the easiest days on paper often turn out to be the ones that really catch you out. And I think that's the reminder to us that you can't relax for a minute on a race like the Giro. And I also have to say the level of organisation today has been, not World Tour standard. I'd certainly say that. Because the logistics of getting everybody up from Castelrotto, which is a start, to Alpe di Susi, really shouldn't be this complicated. But they've made the deviation road between the two small towns, they've made it one way, so we can't drive up it, presumably because it's narrow. So we've now driven all around everywhere, and we're going to have to get in a cable car, hopefully. Oh, Daniel, I remember that day fondly. We must have driven up and down the same bit of road under through the tunnel and round the roundabout and back through the tunnel, and then we found ourselves in a car park, and it went on and on and on, and we thought we were going to miss the stage entirely and miss, well, what has turned out to be quite a rarity, a victory for a Russian rider who is no longer riding professionally.
Yeah, Alexander Foliferov. And we were very surprised at the time, but I actually re-listened to the pod we did that day, and we had a couple of very illustrious guests. We had Dan Lloyd and Ned Bolting. We bumped into them on the way down the mountain. Dan Lloyd, I don't like to do this to him, but he sort of said on the pod, well, we shouldn't be that surprised, you know, he's a guy with decent pedigree, sort of suggested that he would go on to great things. Alas, that didn't happen. In fact, Alexander Foliferov he's only just turned 28, but I don't think he's now a professional cyclist. In fact, he was last seen on Instagram in the San Siro football stadium.
Wow. It was a 10.8 kilometre uphill time trial, wasn't it, to Alpe di Susi? Is that right, Daniel? And he won by fractions of a second ahead of Steven Krausreich, who, of course, was in the thick of the GC race at the time. And Foliferov was riding for Gazprom, and one of his teammates, Sergei Fursunov, was fourth that day. So it was not just one eyebrow raised at Gazprom's performance that day, but both eyebrows raised.
And if ever there's a stage that you would say, well, that can't be, you know, there can't have been some sort of freak circumstances, wind or, a lucky breakaway, it's a mountain time trial. I mean, mountain time trial should be the ultimate test of physical prowess.
I mean, it was a very strange performance, two performances, and for a long time, because they went off pretty early, they were top of the leaderboard, weren't they, Fursunov and Foliferov? Yeah, a result that really does stand out as an oddity. Who's our next one, please?
Well, Rich, we talked about tripling female attention by virtue of winning a stage and taking the pink jersey in the Giro d'Italia. Cracking story, this one. 1982 white jersey winner Marco Groppo. He finished ninth in that Giro. It was his first Giro, 21 years of age. Eddie Merckx said he was Italy's biggest talent and he was going to go on for great things. The next year, 1983, at the Giro, Groppo fell in love hopelessly with a podium girl. I spoke to him a couple of years ago. He said it all started with a glance at the start of that 83 Giro, and it was a lightning bolt, love at first sight. We began exchanging little notes in the morning before stages, then I got a phone number, then finally we were both in the same hotel on the night of the time trial. I went to a room but didn't stay more than 20 minutes. We kissed, no more. Then the next day I got dropped on the first climb because I had a knee injury, and word got around via my teammate Fritz Pirard that I'd been with Mandy the night before. I ended up abandoning the race, and that's where the story of me being ruined by a podium girl started. So, yeah, after that, he never finished a Grand Tour. But when I did speak to him a couple of years ago, he was keen to stress that he stayed with Mandy for 11 years. It wasn't just a sort of whirlwind romance. And he said it was still quite bitter about it, actually, you know, a couple of decades later, because the relationship had eventually ended. And he said Mandy's problem in the end was that she had one very ugly quality. She was too beautiful. It was a curse.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by Science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, enabling us to be here at our Giro. And you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. I took a performance nitrate gel this morning on my ride and, I finished it. So it obviously worked. But speaking of fueling...
Vino del giorno. Chin chin.
So the second wine from Fabrizio Vella is the Rosso Organico that features in the Cycling Podcast Full Giro. The Nero d'Avola grapes are harvested from organic vineyards. They're harvested early, then taken to the winery where majority of grapes are crushed and then fermented in large oak barrels. The other 30% are allowed a process called whole bunch fermentation that retains a little more freshness for the wine. On the palate, the wine for me shows a real freshness, doesn't show sort of anything that's stewed or baked or jammy flavours. It really has some fresh, bright, dark fruit flavours with a bit of dark chocolate and a little bit of tobacco spice at the back end. Now, for £10, I think this wine represents excellent value again, but is also a wine that you could go back for a second glass and not knock you over. I hope you enjoy.
Well, wine of the day, Daniel, what is this we've got today? It looks like a red one.
Yes. So we've got the Fabrizio Vella. Yesterday we had the white, didn't we? Today we've got the red. How are you finding it, Bob? It's a Nero d'Avola. Nero d'Avola is often quite oaked, over oaked. This is the opposite. This is very natural, sort of, I'm a man of the natural world. We've gone with Divine Cellars and Greg from Divine Cellars, partly because they have the same philosophy about wine, a lot of biodynamic stuff, natural stuff. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm just on Greg and Divine. I noticed that he is giving a bottle of wine a day to people who work for the NHS in the UK. So you can nominate nurses and doctors and people who you know are working on the front line in coronavirus, and they might get a bottle of wine from Greg, which is very nice. Right, I'll try and say the right things here. Quite light, Daniel.
Yeah, good acidity, Rich. You noticed that?
Good acidity.
Probably aged reasonably well, that.
It's very
light
nice.
Light tannins. Nero d'Avola, the grape variety. A cyclist from Avola in Sicily. Can you name him? Could qualify, actually, as a Giro supernova. Remember Giampaolo Caruso?
Oh, Caruso,
a fairly recent supernova who actually, I think his career ended. In fact, it did end because of a doping ban. In 2015, it was announced that Caruso had tested positive for EPO. He was given a two-year ban and he's never returned.
Anyway, it's going down a treat. Who is our next? Well, I think we're moving on to a country now, aren't we?
Well, I've got a question for you. What do Jostein Pettersson, Ryder Heisedal and Richard Carapaz have in common? And what do they in turn have in common with Alexander Vinokourov, Primoz Roglic, Bjarne Riis and Cadel Evans?
I mean, this is...
They're all cyclists.
Asking this after wine
easy.
Of the day.
Easy question.
Honestly.
Well, the first three, Pettersson, Heisedal and Carapaz, are the only three Grand Tour champions from their respective countries, Sweden, Canada and Ecuador. They all won the Giro. Vinokourov and Roglic from Kazakhstan and Slovenia, the only Grand Tour champions from those countries, they won the Vuelta. And Riis and Evans, of course, won the Tour de France for Denmark and Australia. But we're going to talk about Jostein Pettersson, because this is a story that really intrigued me. And Richard, you pointed this out when we watched Stars and Water Carriers. There's a scene very early in the race where somebody's finger is running over the list of Giro d'Italia winners, and the voiceover says something like, the biggest names in the sport have won the Giro, and the finger very pointedly skips past Pettersson, the 1971 champion, as if he's not one of the greatest names in the sport, which is a little unfair. It's an interesting story because he was the oldest of four brothers who all turned professional for the Italian Ferretti team in 1970. The others were Eric, Sturer and Thomas, and they were from a village called Forglum near Vårgårda in Sweden, which is where the Women's World Tour race is held. And as a quartet, the four brothers won the World Team Time Trial Championships, which in those days were the 100 kilometre time trial in 1967, 68 and 69. They also won silver in the same event at the 1968 Olympics. And, well, the Ferretti team, they got a job lot of Pettersons. They signed up all four of them in 1970. And in 71, Pettersson won the Giro, a real surprise victory, even though the previous year in his debut season he'd been sixth in the Giro and third in the Tour de France. But he was getting on a bit. He was 30 when he won the Giro in 71. It was a very open Giro. Eddie Merckx pulled out, was due to ride, but pulled out about a week or 4 or 5 days, I think, before the race. The whole Molteni team didn't take part. Gimondi lost a lot of time in the first week of the race, and Pettersson kind of, well, he rose to the top of the classification in the final week, took the pink jersey 3 or 4 days from the end. There was a stage that went into Austria where the race leader Claudio Michelotto got dropped. He was on the verge of cracking for a day or two before that, but he finally got dropped and he hung onto a car and limited his losses that way and got given only a minute's penalty, which the other riders were very unhappy about. The following day, they pretty much worked him over and Pettersson took the lead and then extended it a bit in the final time trial. He is the only Swedish rider to win a Grand Tour. Let's hear a little bit about him from Magnus Backsted, who's the only Swede to win a Tour de France stage.
Well, the Pettersson brothers, they were all sort of cycling heritage in Sweden, you know. And as I sort of started becoming a little bit better and starting to lay down a few results up in Sweden, I got sponsored by a bike shop that was owned by Gösta and his brother Eric. And with that, obviously, I became a lot more aware of what the Pettersson brothers had done through the years. And you know, their biggest thing was the team time trial that they do. Like I said, World Championships 67, 69. That's difficult to do. And then when you've got four brothers that are that good who can actually win a World Championship, I think it's something special within any sport in the world, really.
It does really stand out, doesn't it? Gösta Pettersson's win at the 1971 Giro d'Italia, but he'd finished sixth the year before. You know, he was clearly a very solid rider indeed, a good rider, turned professional pretty late. We're in the south of Italy just now, of course, in our imaginations, and that was a Giro that began in Lecce, in the heel of the boot in Italy, isn't it? And that was quite, I think, unusual at the time, wasn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, well, the Giro has always had a difficult relationship with the south. It didn't produce a winner from the south until Danilo Di Luca won in 2007, and even he was really from the centre of Italy. So yeah, there's always been controversy. The regional governors in the south have always complained because the south hasn't been given, you know, fair treatment in their eyes. But Gösta Pettersson, well, it seems pretty obvious to me, didn't get much fair treatment in 1971. I mean, just going back and looking at some of the newspaper reports about that Giro, it struck me how patriotic, nationalistic almost some of the coverage used to be. In 1971, all the papers could really talk about was how it was a sort of soft win for Pettersson because Merckx wasn't there. And I read a piece in La Stampa, which really reminded me of sort of Napalm before he mellowed a few years ago. Very, very critical of the Italian riders, in particular on the stage to Gran Sasso d'Italia. So this is Gianni Pignata in La Stampa. The Giro d'Italia plumbed the depths today in grotesque fashion, thanks to the obstinate refusal to go into battle on behalf of the favourites, who preferred to drag the race down with them rather than cast off their gloves. We can say now that whoever's wearing the pink jersey in Milan, there's only one winner, Eddie Merckx. The so-called aces snubbed the winning break and instead continued their disconsolate procession as voluntary losers. There was only one difference between them and the herds of sheep grazing in the field at the side of the road, the colour of their jerseys. You know, the kind of thing Napalm would have written a few years ago. And Pettersson, the inference obviously was that, you know, that it wasn't a proper race and Pettersson obviously benefited from that. But he was pelted with eggs, I read, on the penultimate mountain stage presumably by Italian fans.
And yet the Italians, internal politics seemed to hand the race to him in a way, and that's not taking anything away from his victory. But Felice Gimondi and Gianni Motta were teammates and apparently couldn't stand the sight of each other. There's some good background to all this in Herbie Sykes' book, Giro 100, some stories from that 71 Giro. He speaks to Pietro Guerra, who says that Motta rode like he didn't have a chain, and that really needled Gimondi. Ugo Colombo is another guy in this book, and he was in the Maglia Rosa and leading Pettersson by 7 minutes going into stage seven. But according to Colombo, Gimondi caused him to lose the jersey and fall out of contention because Gimondi was also trying to stop Zilioli winning. Had he won, it would have been a disaster for him psychologically and also economically, because the pie in Italian cycling was only so big, and the biggest slice at the time was Gimondi's. So if it seemed as though if Gimondi himself couldn't win, he was determined to stop another Italian winning.
Well, sticking with the Swedish theme just for a minute or two, another rider who had a real purple patch at the Giro for a number of years was Tommy Prim, although he came close but didn't actually win the Giro. He turned pro for the Bianchi team in 1980 and finished fourth at the first attempt that year, winning a stage in Teramo. The following year was the closest he got. He finished second, 38 seconds behind Giovanni Battaglin, one of three Bianchi Piaggio riders in the top 10, Prim was. And well, let's just hear a word or two from Tommy Prim.
The problem during the race and who I realized it was that Bianchi started the race with three captains. It was me, Contini and Baroncelli. We hadn't a team who rode only for one rider, so that decided that we have to work for just him. Battaglin had an advance in that Bianchi was the strongest team, but he left the one after another do the work. So at the final, I was done a good just place, and the next day it was Contini, and the next day it was Baroncelli. So he didn't lose too much seconds on that. Not the final day, but the finish up from Tre Cime di Lavaredo. It was a bad day for me because I was in the back, and the race went very hard up to Cortina and up to Misurina, and I have to work too much for the final climb up to Tre Cime, and there Battaglin had his avalanche towards me. And 2 days after, it was the final chronometer, and I was 50 seconds behind him, and I only managed to take back 12 seconds. So I lost the year because I would say that the Bianchi had, if they had done the decisions to put everything behind me, I could have won that year.
Well, Battaglin, of course, was in real form that spring. He just won the Vuelta, and then a handful of days later kicked off the Giro and won that as well, back-to-back. Prim, the best of three Bianchi Piaggio riders in the top 10. And as he said, feels he would have won the Giro had he been Italian. The following year, 82, he was second again to Bernardino, and he was fourth again in 1985. So a real run of high results on GC without actually winning the Giro. And I think I'm correct in saying Prim didn't actually ever ride the Tour de France. So that was something that wasn't unusual in those days. Riders on Italian teams would not get the opportunity to ride the Tour because the Italian teams often did the Giro but didn't go to the Tour, Bianchi being one of them. But that was the sort of thing that would happen for Giuseppe Saroni, for example, in those years, often didn't ride the Tour.
Well, we've spoken about Ivan Quaranta and Josta Pettersson, and you've named another few contenders, Daniel, for the crown of Champagne Supernova.
Prosecco
Supernova. I do apologise. Can you give us a few more names, please?
Well, I think when we talk about sort of fluke winners of Grand Tours, unfortunately, Carlo Clerici's name always gets mentioned. Winner of 1954 Giro, was part of a big breakaway on Estate L'Aquila, and he got about, well, I think over half an hour over the three big names, the three big aces of Italian cycling at that time, Coppi, Bartali and Fiorenzo Magni. And yeah, won that. He held on quite easily in the end to win that Giro. Giro. Another sort of double whammy for the Italians. He had been Italian and he changed his nationality to Swiss a couple of months before the race. So, they weren't too thrilled about that. Leonardo Sierra, Venezuelan climber who famously won the Stage de Aprica in the 1990 Giro and, again, was very young at the time. I think he was 21. We're going to hear more about that, Rich, later in our Giro. We're going to have Gianni Savio on about how he allegedly acquired Leonardo Sierra, swapped him for 22 bicycles. Not entirely true, but and as Gianni will tell us, but that was what was reported at the time.
Good bicycles or just random bicycles?
We'll get into that, no problem. And by strange coincidence, another Giro supernova, Jose Rujano, another Venezuelan, finished third in the 2005 Giro and came from the same town or village in Venezuela as Leonardo Sierra, and then didn't completely fall off the radar, but certainly never rescaled those heights. And if we think about winners, Rich, well, we mentioned Clerici, another very famous one is Fausto Bertoglio, who won in 1975. Giro finished on the Stelvio, and it was the most watched stage ever on Italian TV.
Yeah, that's one that really intrigues me. No sort of processional finish. Every year when the Tour de France arrives on the Champs-Élysées, someone will say that they should get rid of the procession in Paris and just have the race finish on a mountaintop. And it has happened, 1975, on the Stelvio. Amazing. The Giro, probably the race most likely to try something like that again, I guess. Maybe they will one day. Interestingly, though, the race lead didn't change hands, though, did it? It just stayed the same. The GC just stayed more or less the same.
And another one, Daniel, a lot of people will recall Damiano Cunego's win in 2004. At the time, it seemed not a flash in the pan, but the start of a period of, if not domination, then success for Cunego. He was one of the kind of bright young stars of not just Italian cycling, but world cycling. Had a great rivalry with his teammate Gilberto Simone, of course. And, you know, raced for a long time. He only retired a couple of years ago, but for many years seemed to sort of drift around. He'd never repeated that success, never really looked like repeating that success. Although I do feel that some of his wins are kind of overlooked, you know, due to the fact that he didn't win the Giro again. His wins in races like, you know, Lombardy, Amstel Gold Race, even his medal at the World Championships in 2008 were sort of overlooked because none of those performances quite lived up to winning the Giro in 2004 at age, what was he at the time, 23 or 24?
22.
At the age of 22. So it's tempting to ask what went wrong for Cunego, or, you know, in the end, in the final analysis, was his career a disappointment? He is the sort of one of the great enigmas, I suppose, of the last couple of decades.
Yeah, it was a very strange story, Rich. On Pro Cycling Magazine, we used to have a feature called the Fab Four, where we would pick four riders to watch over the course of the season. And in 2004, we'd picked Cunego. And what we used to do with these features, we used to do a big story with the riders at the start of the year. We would go to their house and interview them. And I went to see Cunego at his home. He used to live in the mountains. Well, his family still lives in the mountains behind Verona. And went there. And it was sort of a typical story you would do in those days, that the family was very kind of humble and sort of working class family, and his brother was there, and we went into Cunego's bedroom, and he had sort of a Jim Morrison poster on the wall and a Pantani poster, and he was a really sort of down to earth kid, and at that stage, you know, hadn't done much as a pro. And then over the course of the season, we would sort of stay in contact with the riders and we would do a monthly update, and I remember the first couple of months of that year he was sort of telling me about where he would finished in the Settimana Coppia Bartali, and, you know, well down the field, but he was sort of starting to get a little bit better. And then I did an update 1 month, and he'd gone really well in the Tour of the Basque Country, sort of finishing stages 10th, 15th. And then over the course of the next 4 or 5 weeks, he went absolutely ballistic. He won the Tour of the Giro del Trentino, won, I think, two stages and the overall. I remember being at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and he'd won, I think, a race in Italy. It was either L'Arciano or the Tour of the Apennines. And the Italian riders coming over the line in Liège-Bastogne-Liège had heard about this from their director sportifs. And I remember Stefano Garzelli just sort of stopping and saying, "What? He won again? Cunego won again?" And then the Giro started and he won, I think, in the first week he won a stage, then in the second week he won a stage. And then, you know, they'd gone in, his team, Saeco, with Simone as the captain, the big favourite for the Giro, and Kunigo just stole his thunder. And the apprentice surpassed the master. And then we had that famous incident where Kunigo won yet another stage and Simone wasn't happy and he shouted bastardo at him as he came over the line. And, you know, it was a great imbroglio in the last few days of that Giro, Simone versus Kunigo. Simone was could be quite a temperamental character, and he ended that year in a very bad mood indeed about what Kunigo had done to him.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary Giro 2004, and Kunigo never really reached those heights again, did he? But his results were good. I mean, he rode a Grand Tour every year from 2003 to 2016. He won a stage of the Vuelta in 2009, which was the only other time that he won a stage of a Grand Tour. But he was fourth again in the Giro, fifth in the Giro. He won the white jersey in the Tour de France. He was sixth in the Tour de France in 2011. You know, he was kind of a figure, a feature, and perhaps, I don't know, a little warning to what can happen if you burn incredibly brightly at the very start of your career, and then the expectation is on the shoulders for, well, the next 15 years.
But the doping question sort of hangs over Kunigo and his career, really. And
but he had that, you know, tattoo on his arm.
Yeah, he had this "I'm doping free" tattoo on his arm, but that was at around very about ambiguous. A time around 2007, 2008, when he was sort of reinventing himself as a one-day rider, a bit of a punchy kind of one-day rider. And a lot of people sort of drew the inference that, you know, that he had, okay, they're making a lot of assumptions here, but that he had almost made a calculation that he could, without doping, be a force in those kinds of races and not in Grand Tours. There was a very symbolic moment, and you wrote a piece in Pro Cycling about Kunigo and the Kunigo enigma a few years ago, Daniel. And there was a moment when Lance Armstrong came back and rode the Giro, and a sort of a moment that kind of crystallized the respective status of the two of them. It was Armstrong was, even if he wasn't at the height of his powers, he was still the boss, and Kunigo was very diminished, it seemed, and they clashed, didn't they, in that Giro, and Armstrong famously uttered the words, "I'll crush you, little prince." And in that moment, also in the nickname itself, there was something quite demeaning about it, and it was a real symbolic moment of how Kunigo's status had declined over those, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, and you got the sense throughout Kunigo's career of just discomfort with the role, the pedestal on which he'd been placed when he won that Giro. I mean, I was there at the end of that Giro, and it was absolutely feverish. You know, people drawing comparisons with Coppi, and Pantani had died. Marco Pantani, Kunigo's big hero, had died 3 or 4 months earlier. And, you know, I remember speaking to a colleague, Paolo Tomaselli, and he was saying that it was like watching a reincarnation of Pantani, or that someone had been sent down to avenge the injustice Pantani had suffered. And, you know, people did get carried away, but then immediately the next season, Kunigo had this glandular fever, and but he also didn't thrive in the limelight. He didn't seem to enjoy it. And the eternal question was always, you know, you mentioned his sort of "I am doping free" campaign. The question was always, in what circumstances had he won in 2004? You know, had he had some kind of epiphany thereafter? Had he changed? There were riders, teammates, Leonardo Bertagnoli, who was a guy who actually got done for, he got busted for doping years later. He always maintained that Kunigo had had his career robbed, that he was actually someone who had had pretty strong sort of ethics all along. But then Kunigo himself was also named in a doping investigation centering on his Lamprey team years later. It wasn't really conclusive, and he was certainly never convicted of anything. But there was just with Kunigo, and there still is to this day, something inexplicable about his career path, or it seemed that way. And you know, I would love to think that one day he would tell us all exactly what happened from his point of view, but I don't get the impression that he will.
Well, that's assuming that something did happen. You know, in other sports, you do get athletes who peak at a very young age and then never quite live up to that, because the pressure, the expectation externally and internally creates demands and pressures that weren't there before, and you're not able to recreate that performance. You know, this is being very naive in a way, but also just applying the same logic to Kunigo and other cyclists as you would apply in other sports.
The other thing, Rich, and we're going to talk tomorrow about another sort of anomalous edition of the Giro, but the Giro, especially in its recent history, well, throughout its history, there have been these editions where the field, if one was to be brutally honest, has either been decimated by scandals or it has been relatively weak. I mean, the 2004 Giro, Rich, just looking at the final top five, Gonchar was second, a very off-colour Simone was third, Popovic was fourth, and I think Dario Cioni was also right up there. And, you know, he was someone who never really came close to doing something like that again.
And although we mock the I am doping free tattoos transfers that Kunigo wore a few years later, it was a kind of, at the time and in that context, quite a statement in a way. It showed some courage, actually.
It did. There weren't many people who were prepared to say anything on the subject at that time, were there? It did attract a bit of ridicule as well, because obviously they were temporary tattoos that washed off. I mean,
committing.
Yeah, there was the unfortunate sort of. Well, it lent itself to an unfortunate misunderstanding. I am doping free. Was he, you know, did that mean that he wasn't paying for, you know?
That was
lost in translation.
The ambiguity of the phrase, yeah.
The Italians love their English phrases, don't they?
Indeed.
Well, anyway, I mean, to conclude our kind of Prosecco Supernovas episode, do we want to pick out maybe three of our own Prosecco Supernovas from the Giro, riders who have burned very brightly but only briefly? There are a few who've done that in a Giro context. You know, you could say Chris Froome had only finished one Giro before winning it, but of course he did perform quite well in other races,
and he left one Giro after getting a toe to the top of the final mountain, his final mountain, on one of the race motorbikes, didn't he, holding on.
Holding on.
He
didn't climb on. But yeah, that's correct. But I would well, there are two obvious ones to me. Ryder Hesjedal, you know, if you look at his win in 2014, it really does stand out as a quite an exceptional performance for him. You know, it sort of cemented his love affair with the Giro, and he went on after that to some more strong performances there. But that was a surprise. Evgeny Berzin, who won in 1994 for Gewiss Balan, a real upset, beating Miguel Indurain there. Again, he went on and performed well again at the Giro, but that is a result, a performance that really jumps out. Even Roberto Vicentini, we mentioned him a few days ago, but he won the Giro in 1986. He had finished up there before, and he was pretty consistently, top 10 in the Giro for a few years, but not somebody who produced those sorts of performances in any other race. So they're my three, anyway.
I thought you were going to upset me, deliberately, gratuitously upset me.
Actually, I forgot my number one. My number one is Pavel Tonkov. A complete flash in the pan. Won the Giro once, didn't do anything else.
Second in 1998, ran amok at the Vuelta on numerous occasions. I thought you were going to actually include me as well, that, you know, I've only ever produced any decent work at the Vuelta, the Giro, as far as the podcast is concerned.
Actually, that's a good shout. Yeah, I'll put Daniel Frieben there.
Honourable mention for Johan de Moink, who won in 1978, still the most recent Belgian Grand Tour winner.
Well, I've run out of mine, but there is one actually that I intended to mention but haven't. Julio Perez Quapio, the Mexican climber who in the early noughties would regularly pop up with stage wins in the Dolomites in particular.
Well, that's our Prosecco Supernovas. I think we can all agree that the standout is Pavel Tonkov in that category, and leave it there, shall we?
Heathen. You're even more of a heathen about Pavel Tonkov than you are about wine. I'm absolutely mortified by
mortified. Oh, I'm only joking, Daniel. Tonkov was a fantastic rider.
Can you not just aesthetically, can you not appreciate, I know you've been watching some clips of Pavel Tonkov because it relates to our next episode, can you not just appreciate the grace and fluidity of the pedaling stroke?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. If you didn't really like him, I'd love him. He's he looked great. rock solid on a bike, wasn't he? He looked great. I mean, I always remember him and Pantani being away, and that contrast in their styles, both very appealing. Yeah, he looked great. I mean, you know, when I look in garage windows and see myself ride past, it's Pavel Tonkov is the rider that comes to mind. Anyway, that's all for now. What's coming up tomorrow, Lionel?
Well, we'll be on Mount Etna to witness one of the biggest explosions in modern Giro history. Richard, your interview with Cadel Evans, who arguably came within 9 kilometres of winning the 2002 Giro. A fascinating interview, one to look forward to.
Well, until then, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
And before we go, we should say some thanks to some friends of the podcast, people who've signed up as friends of the podcast. And don't forget that if you do that now, you will be able to watch our first film, And So We Rode, with Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass. That's available for just under a month now to watch. And it will be, you'll be sent a link by email if you sign up as a friend of the podcast. You can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. And I'd like to say a big thanks to Greg Rowe, Alex Regier, Jason Draper, Daniel Power, Robert Evans, and Marcus Buckle.
And thank you to Robin Lynch, Victor Perez Abela, Matt Hall, Ray Brash, Ian Bracegirdle, and Craig Turnbull.
Thanks from me, from all of us, to Ben Butcher, Bob Duffy, Pete Tomlinson, Richard Hughes, Chris Bourne, and Joe Heim. Can I also thank my dad? I know he signed up the other day.
Is that to listen to the Daniel Freeb special?
Is this thank... no, actually. He didn't know he was coming. I think he got a bit of a nasty shock. is this thanks doping? But I'm going to do it anyway. Thanks, Dad. Thanks, Richard.
You sure he didn't sign up to find out more about you?
Well, that's... No, that is very possible. Le femmine.